feet put on and put these ones in a laundromat washing machine and watch them go around and around and around.
I thought maybe you'd wish for friends, Garrity said sadly. A heady sense of triumph, suffocating and enthralling, roared through him.
Friends?
Because you don't have any, Garrity said pityingly. We'll all be glad to see you die. No one's going to miss you, Gary. Maybe I'll walk behind you and spit on your brains after they blow them all over the road. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe we all will. It was crazy, crazy, as if his whole head was flying off. It was like when he had swung the barrel of the air rifle at Jimmy. The blood. Jimmy screamed. His whole head had gone heat hazy with the savage, primitive justice of it.
Don't hate me,
Markovitch was whining.
Why do you want to hate me? I don't want to die any more than you do. What do you want? Do you want me to be sorry? I'll be sorry. I...
We'll all spit in your brains, Garrity said crazily. Do you want to touch me too? Markovitch looked at him palely, his eyes confused and vacant. I'm sorry, Garrity whispered. He felt degraded and dirty. He hurried away from Markovitch. Damn you, McVries, he thought. Why? Why? All at once the guns roared, and there were two of them falling down dead at once, and one of them had to be Markovitch, had to be. And this time it was his fault. He was the murderer. Then Markovitch was laughing. Markovitch was cackling, higher in matter and even more audible than the madness of the crowd.
Garrity! Garrity! I'll dance on your grave, Garrity! I'll dance!
Shut up! Abraham yelled. Shut up, you little prick!
Markovitch stopped, then began to sob.
Go to hell,
Abraham muttered.
Now you did it, Collie Parker said reproachfully. You made him cry, Abe, you bad boy. He's gonna go home and tell his mommy.
Markovitch continued to sob. It was an empty, ashy sound that made Garrity's skin crawl. There was no hope in it.
Is little Uggy Wuggy gonna tell mommy?
Kintz called back.
Ah, Markovitch, ain't that too bad?
Leave him alone, Garrity screamed out in his mind. Leave him alone. You have no idea how bad he's hurting. But what kind of lousy hypocritical thought was that? He wanted Markovitch to die. Might as well admit it. He wanted Markovitch to crack up and croak off. And Stebbins was probably back there in the dark, laughing at them all. He hurried, caught up with McVries, who was ambling along and staring idly at the crowd. The crowd was staring back at him avidly.
Why don't you help me decide? McVries said.
Sure, what's the topic for discussion?
Who's in the cage? Us or them?
Garrity laughed with genuine pleasure.
All of us, and the cage is in the Major's monkey house.
McVries didn't join in Garrity's laughter.
Markovitch is going over the high side, isn't he?
Yes, I think so.
I don't want to see it anymore. It's lousy, and it's a cheat. You build it all around something, set yourself on something, and then you don't want it. Isn't it too bad the great truths are all such lies?
I never thought much about it.
Do you realize it's almost 10 o'clock? It's like practicing pole vaulting all your life and then getting to the Olympics and saying, what the hell do I want to jump over that stupid bar for?
Yeah.
You almost could care, right? McVries said, nettled.
It's getting harder to work me up, Garrity admitted. He paused. Something had been troubling him badly for some time now. Baker had joined them. Garrity looked from Baker to McVries and then back again. Did you see Olson's... Did you see his hair? Before he bought it?
What about his hair? Baker asked.
It was going gray.
Now, that's crazy, McVree said. But he suddenly sounded very scared. No, it was dust or something.
It was gray, Garrity said. It seems like we've been on this road forever. It was Olson's hair getting that way that made me think of it first, but maybe this is some crazy kind of immortality.
The thought was terribly depressing. He stared straight ahead into the darkness, feeling the soft wind against his face. I walk. I did walk. I will walk. I will have walked, McVree's chanted. Shall I translate into Latin?
We're suspended in time, Garrity thought.
Their feet moved, but they did not. The cherry cigarette glows in the crowd, the occasional flashlight or flaring sparkler might have been stars, weird low constellations that marked their existence ahead and behind, narrowing into nothing both ways.
Bruh,
Garrity said, shivering.
A guy could go crazy.
That's right,
Pearson agreed, and then laughed nervously. They were starting up a long, twisting hill. The road was now expansion-jointed concrete, hard on the feet. It seemed to Garrity that he felt every pebble through the paper thinness of his shoes. The frisky wind had scattered shallow drifts of candy wrappers, popcorn boxes, and other assorted muck in their way. At some places, they almost had to fight their way through.
It's not fair, Garrity thought self-pityingly.
What's the layout up ahead? McVries asked him apologetically. Garrity closed his eyes and tried to make a map in his head.
I can't remember all the little towns. We come to Lewiston, that's the second biggest city in the state, bigger than Augusta. We go right down the main drag. It used to be Lisbon Street, but now it's Cotter Memorial Avenue. Reggie Cotter was the only guy from Maine to ever win the Long Walk. It happened a long time ago.
He died, didn't he? Baker said.
Yeah.
He hemorrhaged in one eye and finished the walk half blind. It turned out he had a blood clot on his brain. He died a week or so after the walk. And in a feeble effort to remove the onus, Garrity repeated, It was a long time ago. No one spoke for a while. Candy wrappers crackled under their feet like the sound of a faraway forest fire. A cherry bomb went off in the crowd. Garrity could see a faint lightness on the horizon that was probably the twin cities of Lewiston and Auburn, the land of Dussets and Aubuchons and Lavisks, the land of Nous Parlons Francois ici. Suddenly, Garrity had a nearly obsessive craving for a stick of gum.
What's after Lewiston?
We go down Route 196, then along 126 to Freeport, where I'm going to see my mom and my girl. That's also where we get on US-1, and that's where we stay until it's over.
The big highway, McVries muttered.
Sure. The guns blasted and they all jumped.
It was Barkovich or Kintz, Pearson said. I can't tell. One of them's still walking. It's...
Barkovich laughed out of the darkness, a high gobbling sound, thin and terrifying.
Not yet, you whores. I ain't gone yet. Not yet.
His voice kept climbing and climbing. It was like a fire whistle gone insane. And Barkovich's hands suddenly went up like startled doves taking flight, and Barkovich ripped out his own throat.
My Jesus,
Parson wailed, and threw up over himself. They fled from him, fled and scattered ahead and behind, and Barkovich went on screaming and gobbling and clawing and walking, his feral face turned up to the sky, his mouth the twisted curve of darkness.
Then the fire whistle sound began to fail, and Barkovich failed with it. He fell down, and they shot him, dead or alive. Garrity turned around and walked forward again. He was dimly grateful that he hadn't been warned. He saw a carbon copy of his horror on the faces of all about him. The Barkovich part of it was over. Garrity thought it did not bode well for the rest of them, for their future on this dark and bloody road.
"I don't feel good,"
Pearson said. His voice was flat. He dry-retched and walked doubled over for a moment.
"Oh, not so good. Oh, God. I don't feel so good. Oh."
McVries looked straight ahead.
I wish I were insane," he said thoughtfully. Only Baker said nothing, and that was odd, because Garrity suddenly got a whiff of Louisiana honeysuckle. He could hear the croak of the frogs in the bottoms. He could feel the sweaty, lazy hum of cicadas digging into the tough cypress bark for their dreamless 17-year sleep. And he could see Baker's aunt rocking back and forth, her eyes dreamy and smiley and vacant, sitting on her porch and listening to the static and hum and faraway voices on an old Philco radio with a chipped and cracked mahogany cabinet, rocking and rocking and rocking, smiling, sleepy, like a cat that has been into the cream and is well satisfied. Chapter 15. Daylight came in, creeping through a white, muted world of fog. Garrity was walking by himself again. He no longer even knew how many had bought it in the night. 5, maybe. His feet had headaches, terrible migraines. He could feel them swelling each time he put his weight on them. His buttocks hurt. His spine was icy fire. But his feet had headaches, and the blood was coagulating in them and swelling them and turning the veins to al dente spaghetti. And still there was a worm of excitement growing in his guts. They were now only 13 miles out of Freeport. They were in Porterville now, and the crowd could barely see them through the dense fog, but they had been chanting his name rhythmically since Lewiston. It was like the pulse of a giant heart. "Freeport and Jan," he thought.
"Garrity?"
The voice was familiar but washed out. It was McVries. His face was a furry skull. His eyes were glittering feverishly.
"Good morning," McVries croaked. "We live to fight another day."
"Yeah. How many got it last night, McVries?"
6.
McVries dug a jar of bacon spread out of his belt and began to finger it into his mouth. His hands were shaking badly.
6 since Barkovich.
He put the jar back with an old man's palsied care.
"Pearson bought it."
"Yeah?"
"There's not many of us left, Garrity. Only 26.
"No, not many." Walking through the fog was like walking through weightless clouds of moth dust.
"Not many of us either. The musketeers. You and me and Baker and Abraham. Collie Parker and Stebbins, if you want to count him in."
"Why not?
Why the fuck not? Let's count Stebbins in, Garrity. 6 musketeers and 20 spear carriers."
"Do you still think I'll win?"
"Does it always get this foggy up here in the spring?"
"What's that mean?"
"No, I don't think you'll win. It's Stebbins, Ray. Nothing can wear him down. He's like diamonds. The word is Vegas likes him 9-1 now that Scram's out of it. Christ,
He looks almost the same now as when we started.
Garrity nodded, as if expecting this. He found his tube of beef concentrate and began to eat it. What he wouldn't have given for some of McVree's long-gone raw hamburger. McVree snuffled a little and wiped a hand across his nose.
Doesn't it seem strange to you, being back on your home stomping grounds after all of this?
Garrity felt the worm of excitement wriggle and turn again.
No, he said. It seems like the most natural thing in the world.
They walked down a long hill, and McVree's glanced up into white drive-in screen nothing.
The fog's getting worse.
It's not fog, Garrity said. It's rain now.
The rain fell softly, as if it had no intention of stopping for a very long time.
Where's Baker?
Back there someplace, McVree said.
Without a word, words were almost unnecessary now, Garrity began dropping back. The road took them past a traffic island, past the rickety Porterville Rec Center with its five lanes of candle pins, past a dead black government sales building with a large "May is Confirm Your Sex Month" sign in the window. In the fog, Garrity missed Baker and ended up walking beside Stebbins.
Hard like diamonds, McVrees had said. But this diamond was showing some small flaws, he thought.
Now they were walking parallel to the mighty and dead polluted Androscoggin River. On the other side, the Porterville Weaving Company, a textile mill, reared its turrets into the fog like a filthy medieval castle.
Stebbins didn't look up, but Garrity knew Stebbins knew he was there.
He said nothing, foolishly determined to make Stebbins say the first word. The road curved again. For a moment, the crowd was gone as they crossed the bridge spanning the Androscoggin. Beneath them, the water boiled along, sullen and salty, dressed with cheesy yellow foam.
Well?
Save your breath for a minute, Garrity said. You'll need it.
They came to the end of the bridge and the crowd was with them again as they swung left and started up the Brickyard Hill. It was long, steep, and banked. The river was dropping away below them on the left, and on their right was an almost perpendicular upslope. Spectators clung to trees, to bushes, to each other, and chanted Garrity's name. Once he had dated a girl who lived on Brickyard Hill, a girl named Carolyn. She was married now, had a kid. She might have let him, but he was young and pretty dumb. From up ahead, Parker was giving a whispery out of breath, "God damn!" that was barely audible over the crowd. Garrity's legs quivered and threatened to go to jelly. But this was the last big hill before Freeport. After that, it didn't matter. If he went to hell, he went to hell. Finally, they breasted it. Carolyn had nice breasts. She often wore cashmere sweaters. And Stebbins, panting just a little, repeated, "Well?" The guns roared. A boy named Charlie Field bowed out of the walk.
"Well, nothing," Garrity said. "I was looking for Baker and found you instead."
"McVree says he thinks you'll win."
"McVree's is an idiot," Stebbins said casually. "You really think you'll see your girl, Garrity, in all these people?"
"She'll be in the front," Garrity said. "She's got a pass."
"The cops'll be too busy holding everybody back to get her through to the front."
"That isn't true," Garrity said. He spoke sharply because Stebbins had articulated his own deep fear. "Why do you want to say a thing like that?"
"It's really your mother you want to see anyway."
Garrity recoiled sharply.
"What? Aren't you going to marry her when you grow up, Garrity? That's what most little boys want."
"You're crazy."
"Am I?"
"Yes."
"What makes you think you deserve to win, Garrity?"
You're a second-class intellect, a second-class physical specimen, and probably a second-class libido. Garrity, I'd bet my dog and lot you never slipped it to that girl of yours.
Shut your goddamn mouth!
Virgin, aren't you? Maybe a little queer in the bargain? Touch of the lavender? Don't be afraid. You can talk to Papa Stebbins.
I'll walk you down if I have to walk to Virginia, you cheap fuck.
Garrity was shaking with anger. He could not remember being so angry in his whole life. That's okay, Stebbins said soothingly. I understand.
Motherfucker! You!
Now there's an interesting word. What made you use that word? For a moment, Garrity was sure he must throw himself on Stebbins or faint with rage, yet he did neither.
If I have to walk to Virginia, he repeated. If I have to walk all the way to Virginia.
Stebbins stretched up on his toes and grinned sleepily. I feel like I could walk all the way to Florida, Garrity. Garrity lunged away from him, hunting for Baker, feeling the anger and rage die into a throbbing kind of shame. He supposed Stebbins thought he was an easy mark. He supposed he was. Baker was walking beside a boy Garrity didn't know. His head was down, his lips moving a little.
Hey, Baker, Garrity said.
Baker started, then seemed to shake himself all over like a dog.
Garrity, he said. You.
Yeah, me.
I was having a dream, an awful real one.
What time? Garrity checked. Almost 20 to 7.
Will it rain all day, you think?
Oh! Garrity lurched forward, momentarily off balance.
My damn shoe heel came off, he said. Get rid of them both, Baker advised. The nails will get to poking through, and you have to work harder when you're off balance.
Garrity kicked off one shoe, and it went end over end, almost to the edge of the crowd, where it lay like a small, crippled puppy. The hands of crowd groped for it eagerly. One snared it, another took it away, and there was a violent, knotted struggle over it. His other shoe would not kick off. His foot had swelled tight inside it. He knelt, took his warning, untied it, and took it off. He considered throwing it to the crowd, and then left it lying on the road instead. A great and irrational wave of despair suddenly washed over him, and he thought, I have lost my shoes. I have lost my shoes. The pavement was cold against his feet. The ripped remains of his stockings were soon soaked. Both feet looked strange, oddly lumpish. Garrity felt despair turn to pity for his feet. He caught up quickly with Baker, who was also walking shoeless.
I'm about done in, Baker said simply.
We all are.
I get to remembering all the nice things that ever happened to me. The first time I took a girl to a dance, and there was this big old drunk fella that kept trying to cut in, and I took him outside and whipped his ass for him. I was only able to because he was so drunk. And that girl looked at me like I was the greatest thing since the internal combustion engine. My first bike. The first time I read The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. That's my favorite book, Garrity, should anyone ever ask you. Sitting half asleep by some mud hole with a fishing line and catching crawdaddies by the thousands. Laying in the backyard and sleeping with a Popeye funny book over my face. I think about those things, Garrity, just lately. Like I was old and getting senile.
The early morning rain fell silverly around them. Even the crowd seemed quieter, more withdrawn.
faces could be seen again, blurrily, like faces behind rainy panes of glass. They were pale, slow-eyed faces with brooding expressions under dripping hats and umbrellas and spread newspaper tents. Garrity felt a deep ache inside him, and it seemed it would be better if he could cry out, but he could not, any more than he could comfort Baker and tell him it was all right to die. It might be, but then again it might not.
"I hope it won't be dark," Baker said. "That's all I hope. If there's an after, I hope it's not dark, and I hope you can remember. I'd hate to wander around in the dark forever, not knowing who I was or what I was doing there, or not even knowing that I'd ever had anything different."
Garrity began to speak, and then the gunshot silenced him. Business was picking up again. The hiatus Parker had so accurately predicted was almost over. Baker's lips drew up in a grimace.
"That's what I'm most afraid of. That sound. Why did we do it, Garrity? We must have been insane."
"I don't think there was any good reason."
"All we are is mice in a trap."
The walk went on. Rain fell. They walked past the places that Garrity knew, tumble-down shanties where no one lived, an abandoned one-room schoolhouse that had been replaced by the new consolidated building, chicken houses, old trucks up on blocks, newly harrowed fields. He seemed to remember each field, each house. Now he tingled with excitement. The road seemed to fly by. His legs seemed to gain a new and spurious springiness. But maybe Stebbins was right. Maybe she wouldn't be there. It had to be considered and prepared for, at least. The word came back through the thinned ranks that there was a boy near the front who believed he had appendicitis. Garrity would have boggled at this earlier, but now he couldn't seem to care about anything except Jan and Freeport. The hands on his watch were racing along with a devilish life of their own. Only 5 miles out now. They had passed the Freeport town line. Somewhere up ahead, Jan and his mother were already standing in front of Woolman's Free Trade Center Market, as they had arranged it. The sky brightened somewhat, but remained overcast. The rain turned to a stubborn drizzle. The road was now a dark mirror, black ice in which Garrity could almost see the twisted reflection of his own face. He passed a hand across his forehead. It felt hot and feverish. "Jan, oh Jan, you must know, I..." The boy at the hurting side was 59, Klingerman. He began to scream. His screams quickly became monotonous. Garrity thought back to the one long walk he had seen, also in Freeport, and the boy who had been monotonously chanting, "I can't, I can't, I can't." Klingerman, he thought, "shut your trap." But Klingerman kept on walking, and he kept on screaming, hands laced over his side, and Garrity's watch hands kept on racing. It was 8:15 now. "You'll be there, Jan, right?" "Right. Okay. I don't know what you mean anymore, but I know I'm still alive and that I need you to be there. To give me a sign, maybe. Just be there. Be there." 8:30. "We getting close to this goddamn town, Garrity?" Parker hollered. "What do you care?" McVries jeered. "You sure don't have a girl waiting for you." "I got girls everywhere, you dumb hump," Parker said. "They take one look at this face and cream in their silks." The face to which he referred was now haggard and gaunt, just a shadow of what it had been. 8:45. "Slow down, fella," McVree said as Garrity caught up with him and started to pass by. Save a little for tonight.
I can't. Stebbins said she wouldn't be there, that they wouldn't have a man to spare to help her through. I have to find out. I have to...
Just take it easy is all I'm saying. Stebbins would get his own mother to drink a Lysol cocktail if it would help him win. Don't listen to him. She'll be there. It makes great PR, for one thing.
But...
But me no buts, Ray. Slow down and live.
You can just cram your fucking platitudes, Garrity shouted.
He licked his lips and put a shaky hand to his face.
I'm sorry. That was uncalled for.
Stebbins also said, I really only wanted to see my mother anyway.
Don't you want to see her?
Of course I want to see her. What the hell do you think? I don't know. I had a friend once, and he and I, we took off our clothes, and she...
Garrity, McVree said, and put a hand to touch his shoulder.
Klingerman was screaming very loudly now. Somebody near the front lines asked him if he wanted an Alka-Seltzer. This sally brought general laughter.
You're falling apart, Garrity. Settle down. Don't blow it.
Get off my back,
Garrity screamed. He crammed one fist against his lips and bit down on it. After a second, he said, just get off me.
Okay, sure.
McVree strode away. Garrity wanted to call him back, but couldn't. Then, for the fourth time, it was 9 o'clock in the morning. They turned left, and the crowd was again below the 24 of them as they crossed the 295 overpass and into the town of Freeport. Up ahead was the Dairy Joy, where he and Jan sometimes used to stop after the movies. They turned right and were on US-1, what somebody had called the Big Highway. Big or small, it was the last highway. The hands on Garrity's watch seemed to jump out at him. Downtown was straight ahead. Woolman's was on the right. He could just see it, a squat and ugly building hiding behind a false front. The ticker tape was starting to fall again. The rain made it sodden and sticky, lifeless. The crowd was swelling. Someone turned on the town fire siren, and its wails mixed and blended with Klingerman's. Klingerman and the Freeport fire siren sang a nightmarish duet. Tension filled Garrity's veins, stuffed them full of copper wire. He could hear his heart thudding, now in his guts, now in his throat, now right between the eyes. 200 yards. They were screaming his name again, Ray, Ray, all the way, but he had not seen a familiar face in the crowd yet. He drifted over to the right until the clutching hands of crowd were inches from him. One long and brawny arm actually twitched the cloth of his shirt, and he jumped back as if he had almost been drawn into a threshing machine, and the soldiers had their guns on him, ready to let fly if he tried to disappear into the surge of humanity. Only 100 yards to go now. He could see the big brown Woolman sign, but no sign of his mother or of Jan.
God, oh God, God.
Stebbins had been right. And even if they were here, how was he going to see them in this shifting, clutching mass? A shaky groan seeped out of him, like a disgorged strand of flesh. He stumbled and almost fell over his own loose legs. Stebbins had been right. He wanted to stop here, to not go any further. The disappointment, the sense of loss, was so staggering it was hollow. What was the point? What was the point now? Fire siren blasting, crowd screaming, Klingerman shrieking, rain falling, and his own little tortured soul
flapping through his head and crashing blindly off its walls.
I can't go on. Can't.
But his feet stumbled on.
Where am I? Jan?
He saw her. She was waving the blue silk scarf he had gotten her for her birthday, and the rain shimmered in her hair like gems. His mother was beside her, wearing her plain black coat. They had been jammed together by the mob and were being swayed helplessly back and forth. Over Jan's shoulder, a TV camera poked its idiot snout. A great sore somewhere in his body seemed to burst. The infection ran out of him in a green flood. He burst into a shambling, pigeon-toed run. His ripped socks flapped and slapped his swollen feet.
Jan! Jan!
He could hear the thought, but not the words in his mouth. The TV camera tracked him enthusiastically. The din was tremendous. He could see her lips form his name, and he had to reach her. Had to. An arm brought him up short. It was McVries. A soldier speaking through a sexless bullhorn was giving them both first warning.
Not into the crowd!
McVries' lips were against Garrity's ear, and he was shouting. A lancet of pain pierced into Garrity's head.
Let me go!
I won't let you kill yourself, Ray!
Let me go, goddammit!
Do you want to die in her arms? Is that it?
The time was fleeting. She was crying. He could see the tears on her cheeks. He wrenched free of McVries. He started for her again. He felt hard, angry sobs coming up from inside him. He wanted sleep. He would find it in her arms. He loved her.
Ray, I love you.
He could see the words on her lips. McVries was still beside him. The TV camera glared down. Now, peripherally, he could see his high school class, and they were unfurling a huge banner, and somehow it was his own face, his yearbook photo, blown up to Godzilla size. He was grinning down at himself as he cried and struggled to reach her. Second warning blared from the loud hailer like the voice of God.
Jan.
She was reaching out to him, hands touching. Her cool hand, her tears, his mother, her hands reaching. He grasped them. In one hand he held Jan's hand, in the other his mother's hand. He touched them. It was done. It was done until McVries' arm came down around his shoulder again. Cruel McVries.
Let me go! Let me go!
Man, you must really hate her,
McVries screamed in his ear.
What do you want? To die knowing they're both stinking with your blood? Is that what you want? For Christ's sake, come on!
He struggled, but McVries was strong. Maybe McVries was even right. He looked at Jan, and now her eyes were wide with alarm. His mother made shooing gestures, and on Jan's lips he could read the words like a damnation.
Go on! Go on!
Of course I must go on, he thought dully. I am Maine's own. And in that second, he hated her. Although if he had done anything, it was no more than to catch her and his mother in the snare he had lain for himself. Third warning for him and McVries, rolling majestically like thunder. The crowd hushed a little and looked on with wet-eyed eagerness. Now there was panic written on the faces of Jan and his mother. His mother's hands flew to her face, and he thought of Barkovich's hands flying up to his neck and startled doves and ripping out his own throat.
"If you've got to do it around the next corner, you cheap shit,"
McVries cried. He began to whimper. McVries had beaten him again. McVries was very strong.
"All right," he said, not knowing if McVries could hear him or not.
He began to walk.
"All right, all right. Let me loose before you break my collarbone."
He sobbed, hiccuped, wiped his nose. McVries let go of him warily, ready to grab him again. Almost as an afterthought, Garrity turned and looked back, but they were already lost in the crowd again. He thought he would never forget that look of panic rising in their eyes, that feeling of trust and sureness finally kicked brutally away. He got nothing but half a glimpse of a waving blue scarf. He turned around and faced forward again, not looking at McVries, and his stumbling, traitorous feet carried him on, and they walked out of town. Chapter 16. Tubbins had gone insane. Tubbins was a short boy with glasses and a face full of freckles. He wore hip-hanging blue jeans that he had been constantly hitching up. He hadn't said much, but he had been a nice enough sort before he went insane.
"Whore!"
Tubbins babbled to the rain. He had turned his face up into it, and the rain dripped off his specs onto his cheeks and over his lips and down off the end of his blunted chin.
"The whore of Babylon has come among us. She lies in the streets and spreads her legs on the filth of cobblestones. Vile, vile, beware the whore of Babylon. Her lips drip honey, but her heart is gall and wormwood."
"And she's got the clap," Collie Parker added tiredly.
"Jesus, he's worse than Klingerman," he raised his voice. "Drop down dead, Tubby."
"Whoremonger and whoremaster," shrieked Tubbins. "Vile, unclean."
"Piss on him," Parker muttered. "I'll kill him myself if he don't shut up."
He passed trembling skeletal fingers across his lips, dropped them to his belt, and spent 30 seconds making them undo the clip that held his canteen to his belt. He almost dropped it, getting it to his mouth, and then spilled half of it. He began to weep weakly. It was 3 p.m. Portland and South Portland were behind them. About 15 minutes ago, they had passed under a wet and flapping banner that proclaimed that the New Hampshire border was only 44 miles away.
Only, Garrity thought. Only. What a stupid little word that is. Who was the idiot who took it into his head that we needed a stupid little word like that?
He was walking next to McVries, but McVries had spoken only in monosyllables since Freeport. Garrity hardly dared speak to him. He was indebted again, and it shamed him. It shamed him because he knew he would not help McVries if the chance came. Now Jan was gone. His mother was gone. Irrevocably and for eternity. Unless he won. And now he wanted to win very badly. It was odd. This was the first time he could remember wanting to win. Not even at the start, when he had been fresh, back when dinosaurs walked the earth, had he consciously wanted to win. There had only been the challenge.
but the guns didn't produce little red flags with bang written on them. It wasn't baseball or giant step. It was all real. Or had he known it all along? His feet seemed to hurt twice as badly since he had decided he wanted to win, and there were stabbing pains in his chest when he drew long breaths. The sensation of fever was growing. Perhaps he had picked something up from Scram. He wanted to win, but not even McVries could carry him over the invisible finish line. He didn't think he was going to win. In the sixth grade, he had won his school spelling bee and gone on to the district spelldown, but the district spellmaster wasn't Miss Petrie, who lets you take it back. Soft-hearted Miss Petrie. He had stood there, hurt, unbelieving, sure there must have been some mistake, but there had been none. He just hadn't been good enough to make the cut then, and he wasn't going to be good enough now. Good enough to walk most of them down, but not all. His feet and legs had gone beyond numb and angry rebellion, and now mutiny was just a step away. Only three had gone down since they left Freeport. One of them had been the unfortunate Klingerman. Garrity knew what the rest of them were thinking. It was too many tickets issued for them to just quit, any of them. Not with only 20 left to walk over. They would walk now until their bodies or minds shook apart. They passed over a bridge spanning a placid little brook, its surface lightly pocked by the rain. The guns roared, the crowd cheered, and Garrity felt the stubborn cranny of hope in the back of his brain open an infinitesimal bit more.
"Did your girl look good to you?"
It was Abraham, looking like a victim of the Bataan March. For some inconceivable reason, he had shucked both his jacket and his shirt, leaving his bony chest and stacked ribcage bare.
"Yeah," Garrity said. "I hope I can make it back to her."
Abraham smiled.
"Hope? Yeah, I'm beginning to remember how to spell that word, too."
It was like a mild threat.
"Was that Tubbins?"
Garrity listened. He heard nothing but the steady roar of the crowd. "Yeah, by God it was. Parker put the hex on him, I guess."
"I keep telling myself," Abraham said, "that all I got to do is to continue putting one foot in front of the other."
"Yeah."
Abraham looked distressed. "Garrity, this is a bitch to say."
"What's that?" Abraham was quiet for a long time. His shoes were big, heavy Oxfords that looked horrendously heavy to Garrity, whose own feet were now bare, cold, and scraping raw. They clopped and dragged on the pavement, which had now expanded to three lanes. The crowd did not seem so loud or quite so terrifyingly close as it had ever since Augusta. Abraham looked more distressed than ever.
"It's a bitch. I just don't know how to say it."
Garrity shrugged, bewildered.
"I guess you just say it."
"Well, look, we're getting together on something. All of us that are left.
Scrabble, maybe?"
"It's a kind of a promise."
"Oh, yeah?"
"No help for anybody. Do it on your own or don't do it."
Garrity looked at his feet. He wondered how long it had been since he was hungry, and he wondered how long it would be before he fainted if he didn't eat something. He thought that Abraham's Oxfords were like Stebbins. Those shoes could carry him from here to the Golden Gate Bridge without so much as a busted shoelace.
At least they looked that way.
"That sounds pretty heartless," he said finally.
"It's gotten to be a pretty heartless situation."
Abraham wouldn't look at him. Have you talked to all the others about this?
Not yet. About a dozen.
Yeah, it's a real bitch. I can see how hard it is for you to talk about.
It seems to get harder rather than easier.
What did they say?
He knew what they said. What were they supposed to say? They're for it.
Garrity opened his mouth, then shut it. He looked at Baker up ahead. Bake was wearing his jacket, and it was soaked. His head was bent. One hip swayed and jutted awkwardly. His left leg had stiffened up quite badly. "Why'd you take off your shirt?" he asked Abraham suddenly.
"It was making my skin itch. It was raising hives or something. It was a synthetic. Maybe I have an allergy to synthetic fibers. How the hell should I know? What do you say, Ray?"
"You look like a religious penitent or something."
"What do you say? Yes or no?"
"Maybe I owe McVries a couple." McVries was still close by, but it was impossible to tell if he could hear their conversation over the din of the crowd. "Come on, McVries," he thought. "Tell him I don't owe you anything. Come on, you son of a bitch." But McVries said nothing. "All right. Count me in," Garrity said.
"Cool."
"Now I'm an animal. Nothing but a dirty, tired, stupid animal. You did it. You sold it out."
"If you try to help anybody, we can't hold you back. That's against the rules. But we'll shut you out. And you'll have broken your promise."
"I won't try."
"Same goes for anyone who tries to help you."
"Yeah."
"It's nothing personal. You know that, Ray. But we're down against it now."
"Root hog or die?"
"That's it."
"Nothing personal. Just back to the jungle." For a second, he thought Abraham was going to get pissed, but his quickly drawn-in breath came out in a harmless sigh. Maybe he was too tired to get pissed.
"You agreed. I'll hold you to that, Ray."
"Maybe I should get all high-flown and say I'll keep my promise because my word is my bond," Garrity said. "But I'll be honest. I want to see you get that ticket, Abraham. The sooner, the better." Abraham licked his lips.
"Yeah."
"Those look like good shoes, Abe."
"Yeah, but they're too goddamn heavy. You buy for distance, you gain the weight."
"Just ain't no cure for the summertime blues, is there?" Abraham laughed. Garrity watched McVries. His face was unreadable. He might have heard. He might not have. The rain fell in steady, straight lines, heavier now, colder. Abraham's skin was fish-belly white. Abraham looked more like a convict with his shirt off. Garrity wondered if anyone had told Abraham he didn't stand a dog's chance of lasting the night with his shirt off. Twilight already seemed to be creeping in. "McVries, did you hear us? I sold you down, McVries. Musketeers forever."
I don't want to die this way," Abraham said.
He was crying.
"Not in public, with people rooting for you to get up and walk another few miles. It's so fucking mindless. Just fucking mindless. This has about as much dignity as a mongoloid idiot strangling on his own tongue and shitting his pants at the same time."
It was 3:15 when Garrity gave his no-help promise. By 6 that evening, only one more had gotten a ticket. No one talked. There seemed to be an uncomfortable conspiracy afoot to ignore the last fraying inches of their lives, Garrity thought. To just pretend it wasn't happening. The groups, what pitiful little remained of them, had broken down completely. Everyone had agreed to Abraham's proposal. McVries had. Baker had. Stebbins had laughed and asked Abraham if he wanted to prick his finger so he could sign in blood. It was growing very cold. Garrity began to wonder if there really was such a thing as a son, or if he had dreamed it. Even Jan was a dream to him now. A summer dream of a summer that never was. Yet he seemed to see his father ever more clearly. His father with the heavy shock of hair he himself had inherited, and the big, meaty truck driver's shoulders. His father had been built like a fullback. He could remember his father picking him up, swinging him dizzyingly, rumpling his hair, kissing him, loving him. He hadn't really seen his mother back there in Freeport at all, he realized sadly. But she had been there, in her shabby black coat, for best, the one that showed the white snowfall of dandruff on the collar no matter how often she shampooed. He had probably hurt her deeply by ignoring her in favor of Jan. Perhaps he had even meant to hurt her. But that didn't matter now. It was past. It was the future that was unraveling, even before it was knit. You get in deeper, he thought. It never gets shallower, just deeper, until you're out of the bay and swimming into the ocean. Once all of this had looked simple. Pretty funny, all right. He had talked to McVries, and McVries had told him the first time he had saved him out of pure reflex. Then in Freeport, it had been to prevent an ugliness in front of a pretty girl he would never know. Just as he would never know Scram's wife, heavy with child. Garrity had felt a pang at the thought, and sudden sorrow. He had not thought of Scram in such a long time. He thought McVries was quite grown up, really. He wondered why he hadn't managed to grow up any. The walk went on. Towns marched by. He fell into a melancholy, oddly satisfying mood that was shattered quite suddenly by an irregular rattle of gunfire and hoarse screams from the crowd. When he looked around, he was stunned to see Collie Parker standing on top of the half-track with a rifle in his hands. One of the soldiers had fallen off and lay staring up at the sky with empty, expressionless eyes. There was a neat blue hole surrounded by a corona of powder burns in the center of his forehead.
"Goddamn bastards!" Parker was screaming.
The other soldiers had jumped from the half-track. Parker looked out over the stunned walkers.
"Come on, you guys! Come on! We can..."
The walkers, Garrity included, stared at Parker as if he had begun to speak in a foreign language. And now, one of the soldiers who had jumped when Parker swarmed up the side of the track now carefully shot Collie Parker in the back.
"Parker!"
McVries screamed. It was as if he alone understood what had happened, and a chance that might have been missed.
"Oh no! Parker!"
Parker grunted as if someone had hit him in the back with a padded Indian club. The bullet mushroomed, and there was Collie Parker, standing on top of the half-track, with his guts all over his torn khaki shirt and blue jeans. One hand was frozen in the middle of a wide, sweeping gesture, as if he was about to deliver an angry philippic.
"God damn," Parker said.
He fired the rifle he had wrenched away from the dead soldier twice into the road. The slugs snapped and whined, and Garrity felt one of them tug air in front of his face. Someone in the crowd screamed in pain. Then the gun slid from Parker's hands. He made an almost military half-turn, and then fell to the road, where he lay on his side, panting rapidly like a dog that has been struck and mortally wounded by a passing car. His eyes blazed. He opened his mouth and struggled through blood for some coda.
"You
He died, staring viciously at them as they passed by.
"What happened?" Garrity cried out to no one in particular. "What happened to him?"
"He snuck up on him," McVree said. "That's what happened. He must have known he couldn't make it. He snuck right up behind him and caught him asleep at the switch."
McVree's voice hoarsened. "He wanted us all up there with him, Garrity. And I think we could have done it."
"What are you talking about?" Garrity asked, suddenly terrified.
"You don't know?" McVree's asked. "You don't know? Up there with him? What?"
"Forget it. Just forget it."
McVree's walked away. Garrity had a sudden attack of the shivers. He couldn't stop them. He didn't know what McVree's was talking about. He didn't want to know what McVree's was talking about, or even think about it. The walk went on. By 9 o'clock that night, the rain had stopped, but the sky was starless. No one else had gone down, but Abraham had begun to moan inarticulately. It was very cold, but no one offered to give Abraham something to wear. Garrity tried to think of it as poetic justice, but it only made him feel sick. The pain within him had turned into a sickness, a rotten, sick feeling that seemed to be growing in the hollows of his body like a green fungus. His concentrate belt was nearly full, but it was all he could do to eat a small tube of tuna paste without gagging. Baker, Abraham, and McVree's. His circle of friends had come down to those three. And Stebbins, if he was anyone's friend. Acquaintance, then. Or demigod. Or devil, or whatever. He wondered if any of them would be here by morning, and if he would be alive to know. Thinking such things, he almost ran into Baker in the dark. Something clinked in Baker's hands.
"What are you doing?" Garrity asked.
"Huh?"
Baker looked up blankly.
"What are you doing?" Garrity repeated patiently.
"Counting my change."
"How much you got?"
Banker clinked the money in his cupped hands and smiled.
$1.22, he said.
Garrity grinned.
"A fortune.
What you going to do with it?"
Baker didn't smile back. He looked into the cold darkness dreamily.
"Get me one of the big ones," he said.
His light southern drawl had thickened appreciably.
"Get me a lead-lined one with pink silk insides and a white satin head pillow."
He blinked his empty doorknob eyes.
"Wouldn't never rot then. Not till judgment, Trump, when we are as we were. Clothed in flesh incorruptible."
Garrity felt a warm trickle of horror.
"Baker? Have you gone nuts, Baker?"
"You can't beat it. Winds was all crazy to try. You can't beat the rottenness of it. Not in this world. Lead-lined. That's the ticket."
"If you don't get a hold of yourself, you'll be dead by morning."
Baker nodded. His skin was drawn tight over his cheekbones, giving him the aspect of a skull.
"That's the ticket. I wanted to die. Didn't you? Isn't that why?"
"Shut up!"
Garrity yelled. He had the shakes again. The road sloped sharply up then, cutting off their talk. Garrity leaned into the hill, cold and hot. His spine hurting, his chest hurting. He was sure his muscles would flatly refuse to support him much longer. He thought of Baker's lead-lined box, sealed against the dark millennia, and wondered if it would be the last thing he ever thought of. He hoped not, and struggled for some other mental track. Warnings cracked out sporadically, The soldiers on the half-track were back up to the mark. The one Parker had killed had been unobtrusively replaced. The crowd cheered monotonously. Garrity wondered how it would be to lie in the biggest, dustiest library silence of all, dreaming endless, thoughtless dreams behind gummed-down eyelids, dressed forever in your Sunday suit. No worries about money, success, fear, joy, pain, sorrow, sex, or love. Absolute zero. No father, mother, girlfriend, lover. The dead are orphans. No company but the silence like a moth's wing. An end to the agony of movement, to the long nightmare of going down the road. The body in peace, stillness, and order. The perfect darkness of death. How would that be? Just how would that be? And suddenly, his roiling, agonized muscles, the sweat running down his face, even the pain itself, seemed very sweet and real. Garrity tried harder. He struggled to the top of the hill and gasped raggedly all the way down the far side. At 11:40, Marty Wyman bought his hole. Garrity had forgotten all about Wyman, who hadn't spoken or gestured for the last 24 hours. He didn't die spectacularly. He just lay down and got shot. And someone whispered, "That was Wyman." And someone else whispered, "That's 83, isn't it?" And that was all. By midnight, they were only 8 miles from the New Hampshire border. They passed a drive-in theater, a huge white oblong in the darkness. A single slide blazed from the screen. "The management of this theater salutes this year's Long Walkers." At 12:20 in the morning, it began to rain again, and Abraham began to cough. The same kind of wet, ragged cough that had gotten Scram not long before he bought out. By 1 o'clock, the rain had become a hard, steady downpour that stung Garrity's eyes and made his body ache with a kind of internal ague. The wind drove at their backs. At 1:15, Bobby's sledge tried to scutter quietly into the crowd under the cover of the dark and the driving rain. He was holed quickly and efficiently. Garrity wondered if the blonde soldier who had almost sold him his ticket had done it. He knew the blonde was on duty. He had seen his face clearly in the glare from the drive-in spotlights. He wished heartily that the blonde had been the one Parker had ticketed. At 1:40, Baker fell down and hit his head on the paving. Garrity started to go to him without even thinking. A hand, still strong, clamped on his arm. It was McVree's. Of course, it would have to be McVree's. "No," he said. "No more musketeers. And now it's real." They walked on without looking back. Baker collected 3 warnings, and then the silence stretched out interminably. Garrity waited for the guns to come down, and when they didn't, he checked his watch. Over 4 minutes had passed. Not long after, Baker walked past him and McVree's, not looking at anything. There was an ugly, trickling wound on his forehead, but his eyes looked saner. The vacuous, dazed look was gone. A little before 2 a.m., they crossed into New Hampshire amid the greatest pandemonium yet. Cannons went off. Fireworks burst in the rainy sky, lighting a multitude that stretched away as far as the eye could see in a crazy fever light. Competing brass bands played martial airs. The cheers were thunder. A great overhead airburst traced the major's face in fire, making Garrity think numbly of God. This was followed by the face of the New Hampshire Provo governor, a man known for having stormed the German nuclear base in Santiago nearly single-handed back in 1953. He had lost a leg to radiation poisoning. Garrity dozed again. His thoughts grew incoherent. Freaky D'Alessio was crouched beneath the rocking chair of Baker's aunt, curled in a tiny coffin. His body was that of a plump Cheshire cat. He was grinning toothily. Faintly, in the fur between his slightly off-center green eyes, were the healed brand marks of an old baseball wound. They were watching Garrity's father being led to an unmarked black van. One of the soldiers flanking Garrity's father was the blonde soldier. Garrity's father was wearing only undershorts. The other soldier looked back over his shoulder, and for a moment, Garrity thought it was the major. Then he saw it was Stebbins. He looked back and the Cheshire cat with Freaky's head had disappeared. All but the grin, which hung crescently in the air under the rocker like the outside edge of a watermelon. The guns were shooting again. God, they were shooting at him now. He felt the air from that one. It was over. All over. He snapped full awake and took two running steps, sending jolts of pain all the way up from his feet to his groin before he realized they had been shooting at someone else, and the someone else was dead, face down in the rain. Hail Mary, McVries muttered. Full of grace, Stebbins said from behind them. He had moved up for the kill, and he was grinning like the Cheshire cat in Garrity's dream. Help me win this stock car race. Come on, McVries said. Don't be a wise ass. My ass is no wiser than your ass, Stebbins said solemnly. McVries and Garrity laughed, a little uneasily. Well, Stebbins said, maybe a little. Pick 'em up, put 'em down, shut your mouth, McVries chanted. He passed a shaky hand across his face and walked on, eyes straight ahead, his shoulders like a broken bow. One more bought out before 3 o'clock, shot down in the rain and windy darkness as he went to his knees somewhere near Portsmouth. Abraham, coughing steadily, walked in a hopeless glitter of fever, a kind of death glow, a brightness that made Garrity think of streaking meteorites. He was going to burn up instead of burning out. That was how tight it had gotten now. Baker walked with steady, grim determination, trying to get rid of his warnings before they got rid of him. Garrity could just make him out through the slashing rain, limping along with his hands clenched at his sides. And McVries was caving in. Garrity was not sure when it had begun. It might have happened in a second, while his back was turned. At one moment, he had still been strong. Garrity remembered the clamp of McVries's fingers on his lower arm when Baker had fallen. And now he was like an old man. It was unnerving. Stebbins was Stebbins. He went on and on, like Abraham's shoes. He seemed to be favoring one leg slightly, but it could have been Garrity's imagination. Of the other 10, 5 seemed to have drawn into that special netherworld that Olson had discovered, one step beyond pain and the comprehension of what was coming to them. They walked through the rainy dark like gaunt ghosts, and Garrity didn't like to look at them. They were the walking dead. Just before dawn, 3 of them went down at once. The mouth of the crowd roared and belched anew with enthusiasm as the bodies spun and thumped like chunks of cut cordwood. To Garrity, it seemed the beginning of a dreadful chain reaction that might sweep through them and finish them all. But it ended. It ended with Abraham crawling on his knees, eyes turned blindly up to the half-track and the crowd beyond, mindless and filled with confused pain. They were the eyes of a sheep caught in a barbed wire fence. Then he fell on his face. His heavy Oxfords drummed fitfully against the wet road, and then stopped. Shortly after, the aqueous symphony of dawn began. The last day of the walk came up wet and overcast. The wind howled down the almost empty alley of the road like a lost dog being whipped through a strange and terrible place.